So, thank you for the introduction. I do work for Mozilla, which is a company that makes this little web browser called Firefox. Specifically, I work in the security and privacy team. Now, that team is part of a larger group called the Platform Group. And it's called the Platform Group because the thing that we work on is the web platform. We try to make the web platform better for web developers. Specifically, our team wants to make the web platform stronger in terms of security and privacy protections. Now, here's an example of the kind of stuff that we work on. Content security, otherwise known as CSP, is a mechanism that basically protects against cross-site scripting attacks. The way that it works is that you tell the browser what external content is allowed to be executed on your page, because of course, by default, browsers will just load content from everywhere and execute it, right? That's basically what browsers are. They're remote code execution engines. And CSP is there to change that. Now, what does it look like in practice? It looks a little bit like this. So this is an example from mega.nz. This is the CSP policy that they're exposing in their headers. And I'm not going to go through this, but this is how it's used in the real world. Now, assuming you have an application that takes user input, for example, a simple application like this, you have a text field, users come in, type some stuff, and then you display it to other people. You could have an attacker that comes in and inserts, say, a script tag, like in this example, right? If you don't do anything and you don't sanitize this input, then you're going to end up with the script tag on your page, right? And without CSP, it's going to do something like this. The script tag will be on the page, it will be executed by the browser, and then visitors to the site will get this executed in the browser, right? This is a pretty benign example, but you could think of a lot of other things that could happen, I'm sure. Now, with CSP instead, what you see is something like this. The script is in the HTML. It's not escaped, because you didn't do this proper sanitization here, but it's blocked by the browser, and you can see it in the developer tools here. There's a CSP policy violation. And so here, the script is not executed. Even though the first line of defense failed, the second line of defense, CSP, did block this script. And a very simple policy can look like this. This is the script source directive, and it controls where scripts can be included from. So in this case here, we're saying self. This is the website itself, right? So the same URL as the page. And in addition to that, we also allow scripts coming from this CDN. So if scripts are coming from anywhere else, they're blocked, including inline scripts. The thing about inline scripts is that they're always blocked by CSP, unless you use this option called unsafe inline. And the reason for that is pretty simple. We can't tell whether the inline script that's on your page comes from you, the website author, or an attacker that just happened to insert it onto your page. So we have to block all of them. Now, CSP controls a whole lot of different things. You can do style sheets, objects, images, etc. And it also comes with a really handy feature called violation reports. So if you want to get a notice every time a browser encounters a CSP error, every time a browser blocks something because of a CSP violation, then you can provide an endpoint directly into your CSP policy. It's called the Report URI Directive. And then at that point, the browsers will post a little bit of JSON to you, telling where the browser was when it happened, the particular directive that got blocked, etc. So that can be really useful if you want to test this stuff out before you actually deploy it for real on your website. You can have a policy on your site that's in reporting mode only. Then you collect the reports, you look up, you basically fix your site or you amend your policy. Once you're satisfied that everything is working correctly, you can make the policy active by putting it in enforcement mode. So that's CSP version 1. CSP version 2 was released earlier this year. We've worked at the W3C to get that finalized and implemented in browsers. And it has a couple of new things. The most important thing, in my opinion, is the support for inline scripts. Now, earlier I said that we couldn't tell. We had to block all inline scripts because we couldn't tell whether they were the attacker's script or your scripts, right? Whether they would intend to be there or not. With CSP2, there is now a way to label, basically, your expected scripts. So you can provide a hash of the inline scripts that you want to whitelist, and then those ones will be executed, but everything else will be blocked. So you can use now with CSP2 inline scripts on your site if you have to, and you can whitelist them that way. There's a second mechanism as well that I'm not going to talk about, but you can read about it online if that doesn't work for you. CSP works in most web browsers. Now you will notice that this little logo here is not Internet Explorer. That's Microsoft Edge, formerly Spartan. That's not released yet, but whenever it is released, it will support CSP, we're told. Very good support in browsers, even though it's not supported by some legacy browsers. It doesn't really matter because it's an extra line of defense, right? You should still sanitize your inputs, but adding a second layer of defense is really good. Here's another example of something that we've worked on and that you can use today because it's been around for a while, and that's called Strict Transport Security. Also known as STS or HSTS for HTTP, Strict Transport Security. And here what we have is a mechanism to prevent HTTPS to HTTP downgrade attacks, right? And the way that works is that we tell the browser that a particular domain, your domain, should never ever be reached over HTTP. It is HTTPS only. And that's important because of a really handy tool called SSL Strip. Now, SSL Strip automates this downgrade attack. And the way that it works is that, say if you go to a typical bank site, you're gonna type the name of your bank, say bank.com.au, into the URL bar. Now, by default, when you don't put in the protocol, just type in the host name, it goes to HTTP. So it will hit the bank on port 80 using HTTP. The bank will redirect you to the secure version of their site, as they should, and then you go to HTTPS, bank.com.au, and that's the page that you can see, right? This is the normal case. You don't have HSTS, you don't have SSL Strip. With SSL Strip, it's actually a little bit faster because you can skip one of the redirects, right? You go to HTTP, and then SSL Strip will just return to you the final page. And the great thing about this is that, first of all, it stays in plain text, so you can look at everything that goes there, right? You can capture username and password, etc. But also, there's no certificate error, right? You're not using an invalid cert, anything like that. You don't have to show a stupid warning to people that users will have to click through. Everything is perfect, right? There's no padlock, but who cares? Like, people don't really notice the difference between a green padlock and a black padlock, so they're not going to notice the absence of a padlock. But this works really well. Now, how do we block this? Well, the answer is HSTS. And what does it look like? Here's an example from Xero. And this is basically all you have to do. Like CSP, it's a response header. So when you return the page from your web server, you add a response header. This one is called, in the case of CSP, it was called Content Security Policy. This one is called Strict Transport Security. And all it's got is this max age with a number of seconds. That's about 12 months, I think. And what that tells the browser is, when the browser sees this, it remembers that the domain it's on, which is login.xero.com in this example, that can only be reached over HTTPS. And so it will remember that for 12 months. And there's a little data structure somewhere in the browser that remembers this. And so the next time you try to go there, you'll go straight to HTTPS. So here is the same example. This time we have SSL strip on, but because we have HSTS, when we type in bank.com.au, it goes straight to HTTPS. If we were to type in HTTP bank.com.au, it would still go to HTTPS. There is no way to go to HTTP for a site that has HSTS turned on. So if you are planning on switching back to HTTP, not a good idea in general, but also but definitely not a good idea to use HSTS. Another thing is if you follow a link that has HTTP in it, it will be silently upgraded to HTTPS. Is that a question? Yeah. That's a very good point, and I'm not going to repeat it because it's on the next slide. So as I said, that you get a silent HTTP to HTTPS redirect, right? And there is no HTTP traffic for SSL strip to tamper with, right? Because in this case, everything happens over HTTP. the opposite. Because it's HSTS, everything's over HTTPS all the time. There's no plaintext traffic to tamper with, right? There is no redirection that happens in plain text. Everything's over HTTPS, except for what this gentleman was talking about here. The very first time, the browser doesn't know that that domain is HTTPS only, right? The very first time, if you are being man in the middle using SSL strip, you could be subject to the attack that I've described before. Now, okay, it's the first time. It's not as bad as all the time, but it's still a problem. The very first time, it'd be nice if we have a domain that's always that should always be HTTPS, right? What can't we do something to fix the very first visit? And the answer is yes, and that's called the preload list. So browsers now have built into them a list, a fixed list of domains that are only available over HTTPS. So these are domains where the domain owner has requested to be added to this list through this web form here. And if you request to be added, then it'll basically be compiled into the browser. So there is absolutely no way for anybody to talk to you using these browsers over HTTP. Again, if you're planning on moving away from HTTPS, I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but you know, you definitely do not want to be on that list. Okay, I've got a little quiz for you. How many sites in the .au top-level domain do you think are on the preload list? Can I guess a few guesses? Yep?
None.
Zero. Well, I have an optimist. Any other guesses?
Four. Three.
Four. Three. Any other numbers?
All of them.
All of them. So that's like a gazillion? the answer is 16, and those are what they are. You can see a security company at the top, not too surprising, I guess. But these are basically the only domains in .au that are on the preload list. I'm sure there's four more that actually use HSTS, but those are the only ones that are preloaded currently in browsers. The interesting thing is that about half of them are hosted on Cloudflare. So I don't know if Cloudflare automatically submits sites to the preload list. Not quite sure what's going on there, but it's probably not a coincidence. Now, HSTS is available on all the same browsers. Again, Microsoft Edge, not IE. So you can feel free to use it today. It works really well. A lot of good support all over the place. Now, if you work for a bank, you should use HSTS because there's basically no reason for you not to use it. Why would you want your customers to go to an HTTP version of your online banking, for example, right? So if you're not using it, please come talk to me after the talk, because I want to understand why you're not using it, and I want to see if we can do anything to help you adopt this technology, because it's really simple to do, and it's quite effective. So I'm looking forward to talking to you if you work for any of those banks, or any of those as well. So yeah, please come talk to me. Yes, you have a question. Sorry, what was the question? The preload list, yes. Very good question. The question is, Is there a separate list for each browser? Do you have to talk to Chrome, Firefox, IE, et cetera? Well, you don't have to talk to IE because they don't have HSTS yet, so it's one less to do. Basically, Chrome got started the list first, and everybody uses their list now, as far as I can tell. So the list that's in Firefox, we pull from Chrome. So the web form that I showed earlier, that goes to Adam Langley at Chrome, and he maintains the list for basically pretty much everyone. Yep. The question is, how are the entries in that list authenticated to prevent someone from DOSing the, if someone is using HTTP and you get them added to that list, they're not going to have a happy time. The first thing is they check that you are already using HSTS on your site, and that you are using it with a long expiry. So it has to be at least 6 months, ideally 12 months. I don't remember exactly, because when I did it for some Mozilla domains, I emailed Adam, and at the time the form didn't exist, so he replied back and asked for some information. Now the process has changed a little bit. I think there's an automated way of authenticating people, and then he double checks it. I think it hasn't happened yet that people, I think what has happened before is that some people have let go of the domain, and then someone else had bought the domain, and it was still in the list, kind of thing. But in terms of a competitor maliciously getting someone added to the list, I don't think that has happened yet. And it's probably good enough for the list is not very big; it's about 2,000 entries or something like that. So it's not a whole lot of process. So all I've talked about so far is stuff that we've done in the past. Right, it's things that you can use today. They're very, very well supported in browsers. I want to switch gears and talk about something that we're working on this year that is not yet in browsers but will be very soon. That's a new specification called Subresource Integrity. So if you go to a typical news website, I'm picking on news websites because they do this a lot, but there's lots of other sites that do this. When you load a page like this, the front page of stuff.co.nz, for example, you're not loading just one HTML page. You're loading a lot of resources. In this example, we're loading stuff. So this is the Lightbeam add-on to Firefox, which shows you various third parties that are involved in as you're browsing the web. We're loading 40 different stuff from 40 different third parties when we load that web page. Right? That's a lot of stuff. If you look in the developer tools, here's just a sample. There's a couple more pages of this, but a sample of all the JavaScript that's pulled in from other domains. Now, the important thing to note here is that every one of these JavaScript files that are loaded, they basically are executed in the same security context as the page. So they can mess with your page, or rendering, and they can do all sorts of things if they're compromised, right? That's quite a long list. One of these files is this one. So it's a version of jQuery that's hosted by Google, right? Fairly old version of jQuery as well. But basically, instead of serving it themselves, Stuff had decided to use the version that's hosted by Google. Now, how common is this practice of using a version of jQuery that's hosted by someone else? If you look on GitHub, I did this a couple of months ago, and I found 2.5 million entries looking for that specific URL, right? They're all different versions of jQuery, but the idea of loading jQuery from Google is very, very widespread. What could possibly happen if that server were compromised, right? It's used by quite a lot of people. Someone gets into that machine. Now, of course, that machine is maintained by Google, so they're better than the average web hoster, I'm sure. But it could happen that an attacker could get on there, right? And the answer is that bad things would happen, right? An attacker could come in and add a malicious payload to the JavaScript, and then they could do lots of really bad things, right? Steal sessions, data, redirect to phishing sites, enlist visitors into their kind of denial of service botnet. Lots of exciting possibilities for attackers. But it's a simple solution. What about, instead of doing this, what if we did this? Right? As the website author, you put the hash of the script that you expect to see. The hash that you expect from this remote, this external site that you're using, right? Now, of course, what we know about hashes is that if you hash, say, a bit of text like this, then you get the stuff at the bottom. If you change the text ever so slightly, you get a completely different hash. So by putting a hash on the script tag, the guarantee that we get from browsers is that if that script ever changes, then it will be blocked because the hash is not going to match anymore. Right? Of course, that comes with a limitation. It's not going to work for scripts that change all the time. But let's unpack this a little bit. There are kind of three types of scripts that people use. The first one is a dynamically generated script, right? So, for example, a script that will have some user data in it. Depending on who's logged into the site, it will be a different script, depending on the time of the day, whatever. That's not a good fit for SRI, because SRI, sub-resource integrity, the feature that we're talking about right now, because it changes all the time, and so you'd have to update the hash all the time. Now you could, maybe if the script is automatically generated, then maybe the HTML will as well, and you could update the hash, but that's not the use case that we're going for. Another type of script is the immutable script, right? One that never changes. And that's perfect for SRI, because if we take the example of, say, this one here, the version of jQuery hosted by Google, then that's a specific version of jQuery. That's version 1.8.0. If it ever changed, it would be 1.8.1, right? So this particular version will not change. So that's a good example of where you could use SRI. But what about your own scripts? Now, the thing about your own scripts is that they change, but they don't change without your knowledge. Like, you're the one actually changing them. And I'm going to claim that, that's a good use case for SRI as well. In particular, because often you'll be able to add SRI, the hash step, into your static resource pipeline. Now, what do I mean by this? A lot of web developers nowadays use tools to combine JavaScript, minify JavaScript, basically massage the JavaScript and do all sorts of things to minimize the amount of stuff that's transferred over the wire, for example. And so very often you're going to see something like this as part of their development pipeline or their deployment scripts. They're going to take all the JavaScript files, going to concatenate together into a single bundle, and then give that bundle a unique name. For example, you could call the bundle, you could add the hash of the bundle inside the file name. That way, if the content ever changes, then the file name will be different, right? And the interesting thing about this is that if you do that, then you can tell browsers to cache the file forever, because if it ever changes, it'll be a different file. It'll be a different file name, right? So that's a really good performance bonus, because browsers will get one copy of it and then will never go back to the server again to fetch a new version. They know it's not going to change. So a lot of people do this already, right? And the second part of the script is taking all of the different script tags you had in your HTML, like this, and then converting that to a single script, the one with your bundle. Now, if you're doing this, surely it's pretty easy to add an extra attribute and just put it in there, right? Repeat the hash that you have in there. So I think for a lot of people, it will be simple to adapt their deployment scripts or their build scripts, and also tools will probably just add support fairly quickly because this stuff really fits quite well in the workflow that's currently common. Now, what else is an SRI? So far, I've shown you the most simple use case, which is this one. You put a hash next to your script tag. You can also do this, which is provide more than one hash. And the behavior of the browser here is that if it sees one hash that matches, then it will load the resource. So if you use content negotiation or you sniff the user agent to serve different files to different browsers, then you can use that to provide all the possible hashes that that you can serve, and that will work just fine. Another thing you can do is if you think SHA-256 is not strong enough, you can use those ones as well. This is not so interesting right now because nobody knows of any attacks that target SHA-256 that wouldn't target SHA-512, for example. But in the future, that's possible. And also, in the future, we'll want to have better hash values. And so what the browser does in this case is that it picks the strongest hash that it knows about, in this case, SHA-512, and ignores all the other ones. So if you want, in the future, to use SHA-3, whatever that is, and that you want to continue to support older browsers that have SRI, which is an older version of it, you'll be able to have your SHA-256 and your SHA-3, and everything will work just fine. Yep, question in the back. Question is there any performance impact? It's very small because all that code is basically in C++ in the browser. So it happens after you've loaded the script, then there'll be one hash computation, and then we look to see if it matches. So it's very minimal. And most of the time it will happen while you're waiting for other stuff to happen, like other JavaScript files to get downloaded. So I haven't actually measured it explicitly because we expect it's going to be really, really tiny. But yeah, it's not computed in JavaScript or anything like that. It's in the guts of the browser. So what I've talked about so far is actually restricted to same origin requests because of one thing that I forgot to mention. Now, what do I mean by this? I mean, if you're serving a script from a different host, that's the examples I've shown you are not going to work just yet. And the reason for that is because of the same origin policy. The same origin policy is a really important security restriction in browsers. And what it says is basically, if you have one script that wants to access data, wants to read data that's in a different script, if those two scripts are not served by the same host, same origin, then you're not going to be able to access that data. That's a very basic security restriction. And here's an example, right? You have a page that loads a piece of JavaScript that has some secret data. Both of these are in the same origin, so they can read their own stuff, that's fine. But then you add another script, say a social media widget library. Now this script does all sorts of social media goodness. It brings eyeballs to your site, whatever that means. And it also happens to try and exfiltrate the secret value that you've got in the other script. Right? Now that is going to fail because that script is unable to read the value from the other script, thanks to the same origin policy. Now if you actually want to do this, say in a non-malicious case, and if you had data that was not actually secret, then there is a way to explicitly whitelist that. And that's a specification called CORS, or cross-origin request sharing. And what that is basically a mechanism to say, hey, this file that I'm serving, again, it's a header that you, it's a response header, so when you serve the first script that has data in it, you can explicitly flag it as, hey, this is safe, this is public stuff, anybody can read it. And you do this like this, you expose this header. Now, when you do this, again, you have to do this with public stuff, right? If you have anything that depends on the cookie or whatever, don't use this header there, because then you basically bypass the protections that are given to you by the same origin policy. But if you if the script is truly public, you can do that on the server. And then that will enable clients to do a CORS load. Now, a CORS load is instead of having a normal script tag, you add this extra attribute, cross-origin anonymous, and that will tell the browser, I actually want to do a CORS-enabled load. And that if it succeeds, it will give you access to the data from the other script, for example, which is not something you'd get normally. But it will only succeed if the header, the server header, is there. So
If that succeeds, then that's great. You have access to all these things. If that fails, then the script won't even be executed. So this is the complete example. This is what you need to do if you want to use SRI in the most common case of the script being hosted on a different server. You just put cross-origin anonymous in there, and then it will load just fine via cores. You can also use this for style sheets. So script and style elements are supported. So it's link elements here. And if you want to generate a hash, you can do that very simply using OpenSSL. It's a SHA-256 that's base64 encoded. Or you can go to srihash.org, where you have a handy web form. You can type in the URL that you want to load using SRI, and then you get the script tag that you can copy and paste into your web application. Status of the spec. The spec is progressing really well. It's being finalized. I expect that we'll get it ready pretty quickly. And there are two initial implementations, one in Firefox and one in Chrome. So here's what it looks like. This is sample HTML. Now, it's really simple. I've got a style sheet that's protected by SRI here, with the hash, and I've only got a single heading on that page. The style sheet does this, makes the heading red, and this is what happens in Firefox, right? The hash matches, so the style sheet is loaded and executed. Same thing happens in Chrome. On the other hand, if the hash doesn't match, for example, the hash is totally bogus, then it will get blocked, so that you can see the developer tool error here that says that the hash doesn't match, and also the CSS style sheet is never executed. It is downloaded, but it's not ever executed. And the same thing in Chrome. So you'll be able to use that very soon. Happy to take any questions if you have them.
How soon do you think, like roughly?
The question was how soon do you think? So the patch that's in Chrome is basically going to be, I think it's either been enabled this week or it will be next week.
Okay.
So then if you wait a few more months, like that'll be in the developer version of Chrome, so if you wait a few more months, maybe like 3 months or so, then it will be in the stable version. In Firefox, I expect it will probably be in 41, so the current version is 38, so again, a couple more months, and we'll see it. But yeah, as a developer, you'll be able to use it, like using a developer version of Chrome or Firefox. You should be able to do that within the next month or two fairly easily if you want to test two sites. And GitHub is testing it right now, so I have a special account that has it enabled. But yeah, they will be enabling it for everyone once.